And we'll move on to the next one, which is Aaron Allen Fain versus the people. Mr. Middleton, are you here? Yes.
Yep.
You're going to do this one. Okay. So for the petition, we have Sarah Kellogg again. And for the defense, the people, we have Ms. Brady. And we'll be ready. This is a 30-minute argument, 15 minutes or so.
Good morning. Mr. Fain's case presents another circumstance where the trial court needs to give something more than just the modified Allen instruction. There are times when the pattern instruction simply isn't good enough. In Mr. Fain's case, the jury sent out a note which said, if I can find it, I cannot find it. Because I'm on the wrong page. Excuse me. The note said there was one juror who will not change their viewpoint and stated they will not change it. This is on all counts of attempted murder. This situation presents the lone holdout problem. When the court was aware that there was one juror who's maintaining a conscientious conviction, as the note indicates and states twice, this juror has said they will not change their position. I think the presumption from that is that the lone holdout juror at that point has a conscientious conviction, and further deliberations, having the court instruct the jury as with just the modified Allen instruction, pattern instruction, creates the problem that the juror is going to give up that conscientious conviction to return a verdict. Once the juror's note went out, at that point the court had a duty under our case law from Allen, Schwartz, Lewis, Lowe, from this court back in the 70s, to approach the juror's note and to respond to the juror with a sensitive regard for the right for that lone holdout minority juror to maintain their conscientious conviction. Moreover, the note wasn't asking what they should do. It was telling the judge that they were, the trial court, that they were done, that they had reached the point of no further deliberations. They said the person would not change their viewpoint twice, as I mentioned. And the court's response in this case didn't address any of those issues that were apparent from the note. Instead, the court called the jury back into the courtroom and gave the modified Allen instruction. And it told the jury to keep deliberating. It also told them to reach a verdict on any counts that they could reach a verdict on. The court didn't respond to what the jury was telling the court in the note, that they were done, that they had reached a verdict, that one juror would not change their conscientious conviction. Again, this is another point where a mistrial could be declared at that stage.
Do you think, is this the situation in which you're saying it's an abuse, even to one time give a modified Allen instruction?
I think because of the content of the note, yes. I think there are some notes or some indications from a jury that we've been deliberating a long time and we're struggling, that some jurors are having trouble with the evidence or something like that. And, you know, I think that comes from the language of the modified Allen instruction itself, which says the pattern instruction, which starts out by saying, it appears to the court that you've been deliberating for a long time, let me suggest some ideas. That's responding to a much lesser amount of issues from the jury. Now, the court shouldn't just necessarily inject that into every jury deliberation, but when the jury sends out some sort of less clear note, like what happened in some other cases that I'm sure this court is aware of just from its own knowledge of jury deliberations. But here they were saying we're done. They said this person has stated they will not change it. They said they won't change it.
Could I ask a question? I'll take your answer there. But also, this case seems to involve a slightly more complicated situation. then was raised in the others. I don't know if they did, but it wasn't posed this way. And that is, a lot of the complication that we see coming up has to do with just the type of situation in which there are lesser included offenses or other charges. And then we're faced with the problem, what does the trial judge do? How does he appropriately, without finding out what the jury's thinking, give them some instruction about possibly being able to agree on lesser charges? Here, I'm not sure, I didn't go back and look at the record, I've just read briefly what you all have written, but are you saying that the judge was wrong even here to try to suggest to the something along the lines of the post-Lewis or Richardson case that the jury might still do something else and they had an option to agree on other things?
Yeah, I think, I do think without letting the jury know that they had this other option of discharge, it was a problem because there were lessers in this case. The note referred to on all counts of attempted murder, and here the charges were attempted first-degree murder and attempted first-degree murder after deliberation and attempted extreme indifference murder. And then lessers were given on attempted second-degree murder as to the after deliberation charges, but not as to the extreme indifference charges, which was another issue raised in the loss in the Court of Appeals. But the jury had already asked questions about what's culpable mental state mean? What's reasonable doubt? The jury was clearly struggling with these issues and with these lessers. And it came back on the lesser of attempted second degree murder and attempted extreme indifference. It wasn't given that option to have a lesser on the attempted extreme indifference. So I think there were a lot of struggles that were happening here. And I think when the jury sends out a note, and I know with Richardson and, you know, the statute has changed and there's an issue when there's lessers and who can, how can the trial court instruct the jury at that point. I think just this sort of, and I understand for trial judges, for trial lawyers, it's a difficult situation, but, and not to make light of it, but sort of a knee-jerk modified Allen response. We can just give the pattern instruction, that's going to be good enough to cover any situation, is not appropriate. I think the courts do need some guidance. I think that in this case, the jury was saying, this person has said they're not going to change their viewpoint on these attempted murder charges where there are lessers and we've had trouble understanding culpable mental state. There was an issue between, not that this court is part of the cert question, but there's an issue between attempted extreme indifference recklessness versus knowingly and how that played out in the extreme indifference instructions. And I think that this jury was really struggling with that. And to tell the court, this person has said they won't change their viewpoint on these counts, is saying we're done. And so the court needed to approach, and it also indicates that long holdout. So the court needed to do something more than just sort of the knee jerk, I'm going to give the pattern instruction because that's enough. Because it's not enough in these cases.
So what would be enough? So just paraphrase the chief, if you were writing the decision, and you were trying to craft a holding that provides a framework that trial judges can use in these scenarios, what would you have it say?
Sure. Well, I would say, you know, if I were drafting an opinion in this case, I would say, you know, it's clear that the jury was struggling with these instructions and came to a point where one person would not change their conscientious conviction. That is a point where a trial judge needs to approach the jury with a very sensitive regard that it's not going to coerce that holdout into going with the majority of the vote. The judge could further inquire, you've said in your note, this person, well, you don't want to identify the person, but you said in your note that that further deliberations would not be useful. Is that true? And if the jury says yes, then the court says, well, you have this third option, which is you can be discharged if you cannot reach a verdict. It could ask, at this point, would you like to continue deliberating, or would you like to be discharged? And the jury could give an indication, and then the court could, if it says discharge, the court would declare a mistrial. And I think that's a completely appropriate response. It takes into account the juror's conscientious convictions. I think that it upholds what the sanctity of American jurisprudence, that we can have minority votes in this country in juries, and they don't have to give in, and we can just try again with another jury.
I'm not certain that that's not what this instruction does already. I have it in front of me, and the judge went on to say more or less all of what you've just suggested needed to be said, which he said, or she, I'm not sure who it was. You know, don't hesitate to reconsider your own views. but don't surrender your honest conviction as to the weight or effect of the evidence solely because of the opinion of your fellow jurors or for the mere purpose of reaching a verdict.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what you were just suggesting. And then the judge went on to say, I'm going to ask you to return and continue deliberations. If you can't reach a verdict on all of those counts, then let me know.
Right. And the problem with that in this case
let us know.
And the problem with that is it didn't respond to the jury's note. The jury had already said we can't reach a verdict.
But,
and they let the court know. And now the court's saying if you can't reach a verdict, let us know. What would the jury think in that situation that it has to reach a verdict? So I think it, you know, in that modified Allen instruction, the court could have simply added a, and if you are unable to reach a unanimous verdict, you will be discharged, period.
Ms. Kellogg, you're kind of asking us to draw a bright line, are you not? If they say they're deadlocked, then we have to say that they can be discharged. I mean,
my bright line includes circumstances of each case, though.
And I agree, that's exactly where I was going to go, so
okay.
Thank you. But, I mean, in kind of dovetailing with the previous case, I mean, there are so many variables. As I was sitting here, I was writing down, length of trial, day of the week, it was Friday in that other case, it was 5 o'clock, so it's time of the day. How many questions have they previously asked? What's the current vote count? Are there less? I mean, there's just a myriad of variables in this. And I'm asking, are you asking us to draw a bright line if they say they're deadlocked? We need to give the third option.
I think if the court rules as we're asking it to rule in these cases, I think that will help guide the courts with this, not a bright line, but when the jury says something like, some person will not, one juror will not change his viewpoints, and he said he will not change them. I think that is not a bright line per se, but that's a scenario when the court could simply add one sentence to the modified Allen instruction very easily to address the jury's concerns.
Is it a, and I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Thank you.
Is it a carve out for the lone holdout situation, or to answer Justice Boatwright's question, is it just any time they in some fashion indicate that they're deadlocked, irrespective of what the nature of that deadlock seems to be?
Yeah, I think that the lone holdout is certainly a circumstance where, yes, the court should tell the jury, like in this case, so the lone holdout can be one circumstance that puts it on this side of the line. There are other circumstances, but again, you know, it is the totality. I think trial courts are good at totality tests for the most part, and so, you know, it's not difficult to ask the trial court, I think, to take a step back and just pause for a moment and look at everything. How long was the trial? The timing of it? How long have deliberations occurred for? Those are all factors that the court can consider, and among those factors are there's a lone holdout. The jury has asked the court for information about that third option, and then it's a Leonardo situation where the court just answers the jury question and then sees what happens. When the court gives the modified Allen instruction, it doesn't work, as the other case showed. When the jury repeatedly says they're deadlocked. So, for example, maybe there's a case where the trial presentation of evidence took one day, the jury has been deliberating for an hour and says we're deadlocked and uses that word. And maybe the trial judge does have that sense of they're probably not really deadlocked, they just need some guidance, so I can give them the modified Allen instruction at the pattern instruction. The flip side is, say it was a one-day presentation of evidence, and the jury's been deliberating for two solid days now, and they say we're deadlocked. And there's other, you know, whatever the other circumstances of the case may be, but I think at that point, it's clear that they do need some additional guidance. So I think, you know, there can be factors for the court to consider. I think a lone holdout weighs heavily in the factor of just give them one little bit more of information of what happens if they can't reach a verdict. Because in this case, they told the court that they can't, and the court said, if you can't, let me know. And they already did let the court know. And so what were they to think other than the court's asking for a verdict, which is coercive?
Ms. Kellogg, did in this case, did the jury ask what happens now?
No, they just sent out the one note, which says that one juror has stated he will not change his viewpoint.
Does that impact your analysis of this? Because you talked about answering the question, and in this case, they didn't ask that question.
Right, and I'm sorry, I don't mean answer. Yeah, they didn't ask what will happen, so not answering that question, but I mean being responsive to what the information that the jury is communicating to the trial judge. Here, the jury is communicating that this person has a conscientious conviction that they will not change. And so the judge needs to approach that in response, not just by saying, and so if you can't reach a verdict, let me know, because they're telling them we can't.
Can I follow up with that? You've used the phrase conscientious conviction a number of times.
Yes.
Where's that inference
from? That's from People v. Lewis.
No, I'm saying, how do we know that in the facts? How do we know that that person just didn't go back there and fold their arms and face the wall?
I think we know that from the circumstances. So the jury had already sent out three questions asking about culpable mental state, reasonable doubt, and then the instruction of you can use all of the information from your life experience and what does that mean. And they had been deliberating for already at least a day, I believe it was. And so I think the circumstances indicate the juror didn't just fold their arms. This wasn't the jury tried to do their duty. They had sent out several questions. They gotten responses from the judge, just telling referring them back to the original instructions. And it wasn't working. And so they sent out this other note, emphasizing twice that person.
So there's a whole lot of factors that go into any of these.
A whole lot of factors, and I see them out of time.
Chief, may I ask one question?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Is your first position that you would really like to have the Ragland instruction in all cases? Is that really what you would like to see happen?
Not necessarily. I think that could be one solution to this problem, that we could just add on to the modified Allen instruction one sentence.
And I ask that because imagine a scenario in which you get a note from the jury that says we're 11-1 in favor of acquittal. Would you really want that Ragland language given to the jury in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, this takes a step back from strategy, what do we want, what should happen, and what's happening is the trial court is now communicating directly to the jury. It's at a very sensitive point during deliberations. Probably, you know, there's been a lot going on in jury rooms. We don't know, we're not supposed to know. But at that point, it's the trial judge communicating to the jury. And I think the entire framework for these cases is the overarching duty the judge cannot coerce a verdict. Regardless of which way that verdict is going, the trial court can't sanction a coerced verdict. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'd like to thank you, Ms. Kellogg, and also you again, Ms. Brady. Oh, I'm sorry, you're not finished, are you?
I guess I'll give you she has 15 minutes.
I guess I'll give you a shot at it. So. Go ahead.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people. I really just have one short comment, and that is there's no instruction that's less coercive than the one that this trial court gave and that the parties agreed to. I mean, before the actual modified Allen instruction, the court says if there's any counts that you can reach unanimous verdicts on, you should return a verdict on those counts. I don't know whether you can or not. I'm not telling you what you have to do. It just doesn't get any less coercive than that. If that's what we're concerned with, then in this case, the juror was not coerced. We're concerned about did the instructions and comments from the trial court coerce a verdict? And these instructions did not coerce a verdict.
Can I ask you a question about those? Nobody's really mentioned it, but just do you have any thoughts? This seems to be a situation in which there may be an argument the judge shouldn't have given even one time a modified Allen type instruction. Do you think the failure to give any kind of a warning, especially with regard to an option to consider whether the jury could agree on any lesser offenses, would endanger a finding of manifest necessity for a retrial?
I'm going to say yes. First of all, I would just clarify, when you say asking the jury about maybe finding the defendant guilty on lesser offenses?
It sounded like that's what the judge did in this case. And I'm not saying you can, but at least.
Actually, I don't think that's what the judge is saying. Okay. I think the judge is just saying, first of all, the non-murder counts were basically conceded to in the closing argument. So this juror was objecting to all the murder counts. So that would be, even lessers. And in regard to the thing that was said earlier about the lesser for the extreme indifference murder was not given. It wasn't given because it wasn't requested, and the Court of Appeals found there was no plain error here. So just to clear those things up. But I think the court was trying to say, you know, can you come to a unanimous decision on any of these counts?
Counsel, we've had now three arguments. Could you perhaps, and we've heard a lot of points about what ought to be taken into consideration and what not. Could you perhaps encapsulate for us what you would have us write? What would the rule be?
The rule would be trial court discretion, the pattern instructions. If trial court doesn't follow the pattern instructions exactly, then look at the language and see if it uses language that seems to be telling the jury what to do. Clearly, in this case, that didn't happen. And generally, I mean, if the parties are not objecting to the instructions that are being given and the record doesn't show any coerciveness, that's all we can look at. And we can't ask the juror, were you coerced by this instruction?
So the poll star should be coercion, looking at whatever instruction is ultimately given?
Are the instructions coercive? Do you use coercive language under the circumstances on a case-by-case basis?
And in terms of including information about the potential for a mistrial, you would limit it to the circumstance in which it is clear from either communications from the jury or other circumstances that the juror is laboring under a mistaken impression that it's going to be stuck deliberating into eternity. Is that the only circumstance in which you envision it would be appropriate to inform them of the mistrial option?
I'm not going to limit it definitely just to that. That is one unique circumstance, I think, where it would be appropriate. Again, it would be up to the defense to make an argument that we need this instruction, and here's why.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I think I can safely thank both of you. So thank you, Ms. Kellogg, and thank you, Ms. Brady, for helping us with these cases this morning. We'll be